Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you as I recover from COVID here in the mountains of Utah. A quick reminder that as of release of this episode, we are just a few weeks away from the launch of my new epic fantasy, In the Shadow of Lightning. I'm sorry, not sorry, that I keep harping on it, but get those pre-orders in. I am thankful and I love you all. Now on with the show. My guest this week is YouTuber Tim Hixon. Tim is the owner, writer, and performer of the wildly popular Hello Future Me channel, where he breaks down plot, characters, and world building. He's also the author of two books on the subject, On Writing and World Building, Volumes 1 and 2. Tim and I talk about the pressures of success, Tim's journey towards publishing his own fiction stories, the difficulty of pleasing yourself, fans, and algorithms all at once, and the cold hard reality of using art to pay your bills. Enjoy my conversation with Tim Hixon. Well, so are you a Tim or a Timothy?
I'm a Tim. If you would like to be firm with me, feel free to say Timothy. if that's more comfortable, you know. But no, otherwise I am just Tim.
Yeah, I was always, when my parents were mad at me, I was always Brian Thomas.
Oh, yeah, Brian Thomas, yeah, Timothy Matthew.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
If they bust out that middle name, you know you are screwed.
Absolutely, I'm getting grounded, sent to my room, till I realized I could read books, and then that's fine.
Right, you know, it's, I think a lot of parents are really happy when they're teenagers, like, just disappear quietly,
mm-hmm.
and maybe the worst thing they do is rack up library fines.
Yeah. I discovered when I was about eight. No, sorry. I read The Hobbit when I was about seven, and then from there on, my love of fantasy grew, and I very quickly retreated into my room by nature. And so they had to find new punishments for me.
Right. Yeah, I was one of those kids that, like, you know, go to your room didn't work on me.
Right.
Like, just because, oh, my room's where I wanted to be in the first place. This is a great place.
Yeah, I had a bunk bed, and I had two couches that were facing, like, two single couches facing each other under my bunk bed. And that was like a little reading hammock for me, where I could read Aragon 13 times when I was 11.
Oh, man, that sounds so fantastic. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had a bit more variety, but the setting was lovely.
Yeah. I had whatever the library kind of had in stock. You know, my parents never took me to bookstores. We didn't really have a ton near us, but my mom volunteered at the library every week, so I was always there, always coming out with a big old stack of something. Man, I love those. Something that I've never been able to replicate as an adult is that feeling of reading so much and for so long that, like, your, like, various limbs go numb and you have to, like, find new positions, but you never put down the book the entire time. You're just rolling around your bedroom trying to be comfortable.
I know. I totally agree with that. I remember, you know, like, I'd be, like, reading upside down, you know, hanging over the edge.
Yeah.
And, like, as an adult, maybe I just don't have, like, that ability to be as fixed. Like, it's almost like, you know, the book itself is the axis around which your body turns, you know. But now your body turns around the pains in your spine.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I was kind of curious about something. As somebody who has, from what I can tell, made quite a good career out of doing reviews and talking about the minutiae of storytelling and world building and character and stuff like that, have you found that your personal enjoyment of things has gone down over the course of your career?
Okay, so it's a yes and a no answer to that. What it has done is changed my tastes. what it does, I mean, in the way that the more you delve into any given thing, the more extreme your tastes kind of become in some sense, the more you're looking for that sort of bigger challenge, bigger hurdle. I have definitely found that the more I have kind of studied sci-fi and fantasy, and I have always loved doing that. Like, since I was a kid, I'd sit down and I would read a book and I'd be like, why did I love this book? Like, what made this book resonate with me? And I would try and figure that out. And so this is really an extension of that. But the more I've done that in a professional context, the more I've found that I prefer really experimental books. I tend to find that, I don't want to use the term conventional, but perhaps familiar. The stuff that has the, you know, the hero and the villain and the and a lot of those familiar tropes that we're very, that we know a lot, that we see a lot, I don't get as much out of those as I perhaps used to. And so I've turned to love, you know, like Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation was just, I adored that. That was so different to anything I'd really read, because it was intensely literary while also being really complex science fiction. And Adrian Tchaikovsky's Children of Time is another favorite of mine. Very, very different. So yeah, my tastes have definitely deepened. I not deepened, just become more complicated, but
shifted, maybe
shifted. Yeah. But I mean, you are on the other end of this, like you're writing this stuff. I mean, you are, it's that weird thing where, you know, you're writing it and you're also reading it. So how has that affected you?
Honestly, I don't read much anymore, which is like it's almost like the tragedy of my pretty successful career,
mm-hmm.
is that I took something that I really loved as a kid. I mean, I read voraciously until probably around 24, 26-ish, right around when my career started. I just read voraciously. I would get anything. I would devour books in 24 hours, you know, the big honker epic fantasies and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then as soon as I started doing it for a living, I just, like the urge to read kind of disappeared. And I always found myself analyzing stuff and analyzing it in a way that wasn't fun for me. And I've been trying, part of this podcast is because I asked this similar question to a lot of my guests, and part of this has been me trying to figure out how to come back around to really loving things a lot more, and kind of shedding my my writer brain when I'm watching something, when I'm reading something, all that stuff. But that, it's hard. I know a lot of writers still read voraciously, and I'm very jealous of those people. But I've also come across quite a few who just kind of, you know, as soon as they kind of got their career going, they just kind of tapered off and they just don't really read that much anymore.
Yeah, I've encountered that with some people. It's got to be heartbreaking in a way. It feels like losing a part of yourself in some way, even though you've found, you know, this incredible successful writer career with one of the big, you know, fantasy series out there at the moment. You know, Powder Mage and all that.
Yeah,
it's quite incredible. I'm really impressed.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's a weird little kind of double-edged sword thing. And I found myself lately, I've been really trying hard to enjoy things more for what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this isn't a book, but like my best example is did you watch The Mandalorian when it came out?
It's actually the only one of those kind of new Disney Star Wars Marvel series. I've watched that and Loki, because I'm just not really into those universes, but those are the only two that I watched, and Mandalorian was really good.
So the thing is that Mandalorian, I don't think it was good. And a lot of my writer friends, like on Twitter and stuff, it just exploded. Everybody was being critical and stuff about it. The thing is that I don't think it was good, but I really enjoyed it. I forced myself to sit down and watch it and just kind of enjoy the whole process. Enjoy, like, one of the things that my wife and I really enjoyed about it was talking about what the obvious influences were for every episode. You know, things like that. Like, really getting into the kind of the joy behind the series rather than, you know, letting my writer brain be like picking apart, okay, this didn't make sense, this is kind of stupid, this is all this stuff. And And I found a couple of those new Star Wars things. Book of Boba Fett was particularly egregious in terms of...
I've heard that was not that great, yeah.
Right, in terms of like, you know, these things don't make sense. This is kind of a weird way to go with it. But again, I just kind of made myself sit back and just kind of enjoy just kind of, you know, being a kid again, you know, and saying, holy crap, there's Star Wars on TV. This wasn't a thing, you know, 10 years ago. This is kind of cool.
I very much have that with Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, which in some ways, you know, stories aren't necessarily enjoyable because they're really well written or profound, which is something that I know the elitist part of me looks for. And, but like Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, it's just so fun. It's so bombastic and it's
that the third one?
That's the third one. Sorry. Yeah. So that's
right. Okay.
That's the third one, which, you know, first one was well known. Second one was pretty well received. Third one was a lot of fun, but technically not that great.
Right. Like there's the scene with Barbossa marrying them. During yes. the sword
yeah, fight. Yeah. I'm a little busy at the moment.
Right. It's so incredibly stupid, but it also is so fun.
Yeah.
Like, there's that balance you kind of have to make. And I feel like in the recent years in my career, and this is what I'm trying to counter now, is I find in recent years that I take myself and writing so seriously that I kind of take things like that and just dismiss them and be like, oh, that was dumb. It's, you know... And I'm really trying to dig more into kind of, okay, there's some things that maybe they're really stupid from a storytelling point of view.
Yeah.
But they're still awesome, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I get where that feeling, though, you're talking about kind of comes from in the sense that, like, my career is at the moment, it's very based around how much media I can consume and analyze. And because of that, I have to look for stuff that I feel I can draw on a lot of the time. And it does, in a way, a lot that sort of desire to find those things comes from that fear of, like, this thing, this kernel of amazingness that you've got at the moment, this fear of it all just falling apart and you need to make sure that it's there and that it stays there. And you've got to keep putting in good material instead of just enjoying things. I don't know if that's a familiar experience for you, but that is part of it for me, is that I'm focused on the career rather than necessarily enjoying the actual stuff I'm watching and reading.
I definitely suffer from that. I when you talk about creativity and things like that, you know, so many authors have these like deep wells that they can reach into of my passion comes from X, Y, and Z. And man, it's sometimes I'm like, oh, my passion comes from really not wanting to ever have to work a 9-to-5 crappy job again.
Oh man, I have never worked a 9-to-5 job. So you climbed out of the void, out of the depths. I'm like trying to run away from the edges in the first place, you know, because I fell into this at university, and so. Yeah, I'm like, oh, I'm. If I ever had to work in an office with other people instead of on my own, I would just be inept.
Right. I feel like, you know, because I think I'm closing in on. I've been full time as an author for a bit over 10 years, and next year will be 10 years from the start of the launch of my first book. Hmm. So, you know, a decade of a career. And I look back and go, man, I don't even know how I would function in a normal job. Any kind of normal job, whether it's an office job or flipping burgers or anything, like I couldn't function in any of that.
That's crazy. And like the arc of your career. So that first year where like you became professional, where are you now compared to then? Like personally in your work, like how man. You think of yourself in your work?
It's weird to look back on it because I tend to look back on like cold hard facts kind of thing. Like I'll be like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm making X amount of money more, you know, that kind of stuff. But like from like a psychological perspective, I think I'm a little more secure, you know, like in that in terms of I don't feel as panicked about, okay, is my first book going to flop? You know, is my second book going to flop? Is my third book going to flop? You know, like there's always that thing going, you know, even New York Times bestsellers will tell you the same thing. They'll say, yeah, there's always that little thing in the back of my head saying, you know, asking whether I'm going to fail at some point. And that's still there. But I think it's definitely less than it used to be. You know, I have a lot more confidence in, okay, if I do have a book flop, I can probably make up somewhere. I'll start a new series, or I'll self-publish something. I'll, you know, jump to a different contract. You know, I have the skill set and kind of...
You've got enough credibility built up that you could be flexible.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I could probably recover if something disastrous happened.
Yeah.
But early in my career, I did not feel that way. It was very much swimming for all I was worth to try to, you know, hope that that extra tweet going out would maybe get me a few more people that would read the book, you know, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's, you're so focused on those like little numbers at the start. And it feels like it's all about to fall apart, because a lot of the time you don't feel like you've necessarily earned it.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of something that has happened to you and you are trying to take advantage of, but in the same way that it... At least, I mean, I don't know if this is how you felt, but for me, it was kind of like, this thing has happened to me, and I'm trying to take advantage of it, and as easily as it came to me, it could be taken away. And there's that lack of control in many senses that's kind of terrifying when you're self-employed.
Oh, yeah, and I totally get that, and I think that's a very big thing for any creative professional at all. Because, you know, we don't get performance reviews. You know, we don't get a 5% raise because
we just get really paid well. Less.
Right, exactly. Like,
yeah.
Like, we have no idea. And the fact is that for a lot of us, you know, our income can vary wildly from month to month or quarter to quarter and definitely from year to year. Like, these things, they go up and down so much, and you can kind of try to keep your finger on it and like kind of understand, okay, you know, I know that my sales on my backlist dipped a little bit last year. I can probably expect to make a bit less. You know, you kind of have a general understanding, but honestly, you know, you could suddenly get a foreign rights offer that, you know, for 30 grand that suddenly, oh, that's a big boost.
Yeah.
Or you go for 2 years without a single foreign rights offer or something like that. And you're like, oh, that little bit of extra income I was hoping for is not happening.
I've recently had like a South Korean publisher reach out and get the foreign rights to a couple of books that I did. And I was just like, it was completely out of the blue. I had no idea. And then they offered me this amount of money, you know, like $3,000 US. And I was just like, why not? I suppose. But I mean, I don't expect that to happen with anyone else, but it does fluctuate a lot, and it's a very weird space to live in a lot of the time, the uncertainty.
Well, and for guys like you who do, I'm making the assumption that most of your income comes from YouTube.
Everything comes from YouTube in an indirect sense. But the actual income streams that I have about 7 different income streams, which vary between ad revenue, sponsorship, Patreon, book sales, and freelance work, and a couple of other small things. But yeah, the majority of it's all indirectly tied to YouTube.
Yeah. No, and is that a monthly payout then, or is that quarterly?
Well, they're all different. So the YouTube payouts come out on the 20th of each month.
Mm-hmm.
Book sales come through every 3 months, which I'm sure you know as well as I do. Then Patreon is on the first of each month, and then freelance is often hourly. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
So it's all coming in different spots. It's very like it's just unexpected. And you can get an idea, like, you know exactly when you get paid every month for those monthly things, right?
Yes, and, yes.
You know, everybody has kind of those, you know, for me, I've get, you know, my royalty checks are twice a year in April and October. And
I can usually expect that. Twice a year? Yeah. Twice a year?
Yeah.
That's hot. Oh my gosh. What, like, how do you navigate that? Like, that's...
carefully.
Carefully.
The first probably 4 years of my career, like those 2 or 3 months before a royalty check dropped, I was definitely like, I was rolling over credit card debt, you know, because normally I'm one of those people that pays off my credit cards every single month, you know, never carry a balance.
Oh my gosh.
But those first 4 years or so, I was, you know, carrying balances on my credit card just to try to be like, okay, I know I'm going to get paid in a couple of months, you know, like, but honestly, and that's why I started doing a lot of self-publishing with like little novellas and things like that, is because I was like, man, I need something that's just bringing me in $1,000 or $2,000 a month just for consistency.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that kind of thing, you kind of have to fiddle with and make it work for your career and for your home life and all that stuff.
Absolutely. It's interesting. So I'm in a weird position, you know, I'm in one of those weird positions where I have an audience that I could self-publish to and it would do well. Like I have an audience that I could, I have self-published two books, you know, textbooks type things. And they have done
your world building books, right?
Yeah. And they have like leaps and bounds beyond what I thought. I thought I would sell, I budgeted to sell 500 copies and they've sold like 50,000. So
that's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And the funny thing was, is that it went way, I did not for a second anticipate it would go beyond my niche audience. And then I learned that it did. And that had its own negative consequences, but I can't get into that now. What I was going to say is like, I really want to like traditionally publish like this fiction book. But yeah, like the choice of whether or not to self-publish or traditionally publish when you've got an audience, it's a complicated one, especially because it's a lot to do with credibility. You know, regardless of how the self-publishing industry is changing, people look at traditional publishing as with its gatekeeping in some ways as a way of finding credibility. And I know that there are books published which are not that good. Don't get me wrong, but that's still an element to it there. And yeah, that's a difficult one to, there's the temptation to self-publish, but I have to avoid that for this particular project for me personally.
Well, I imagine that's something that you just kind of, you have to struggle with that, right? You have to kind of, you have to look at your options and you have to say, okay, what's good for me as a career? What's good for me as a public facing person? What's good for me personally? Like there's so many things you have to juggle with that kind of decision.
Yeah. I've always viewed, right from the start, I always viewed this YouTube stuff as a platform to eventually become an author. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the way I look at it is kind of like, I feel like being traditionally published is going to give me more longevity, theoretically, in the future, at least at the moment. And I don't know how accurate that is. It's so hard to predict this sort of thing. But it's getting your hands and roots into a business, fundamentally, mm-hmm. into an industry. That self-publishing wouldn't quite let me do yet. It would still be sort of existing in my own little bubble. Yeah. So, that is a dilemma that I've many YouTubers encounter.
Oh yeah. No, I'm sure it's definitely a, I mean, even for established authors, that's something that goes through everybody's head of, cause there's plenty of authors who are very straightforward of, I don't want to deal with all the back end stuff.
Yeah.
I want to hand a book to someone and have them publish it, period. That's it. But, you know, we've kind of reached that point in kind of the way self-publishing works and the industries all work and everything like that, where it's very, really quite, maybe not easy.
Viable.
But it's viable, right? It's quite viable for...
I mean, you published... I mean, how many novellas have you published, self-published?
I think I've got maybe 6 novellas and a short story collection, or 5 novellas and a short story collection.
Nice.
And honestly, it wasn't all that much work for me. And I enjoy doing little fiddly bits like that occasionally.
Mm.
So I was in a good position to do it. And to be frank, they've made me pretty good money.
Yeah.
But I still make 80% of my income from traditional publishing.
Right.
So it's, you know, like these things are all, you know, every author will say, okay, yeah, that's a thing. When I'm looking at a new book that I've got and I'm ready to send it out to publishers, I stop and think, should I self-publish it?
Hello, Page Break listeners. Brian here to let you know that my next epic fantasy, In the Shadow of Lightning, is now up for pre-order from Tor Books. Glass Immortals is a whole new universe that introduces you to assassinations, intrigue, industrial magic, harrowing battles, heartbreaking disasters, and more for new readers and old. The book is out in the US on June 21st and can be pre-ordered from Amazon, Audible, Barnes & Noble, or get a signed copy straight from my website. Remember, pre-orders matter massively to a new book, so make sure you get that done. Thank you all so much for the support. Now enjoy the rest of the podcast.
has there been any projects that you've done that like publishers are like, I don't know if I can, if we should really put this out. And so you decide to put it out as a self-published novel?
Honestly, this one right here, actually, Uncanny Collateral, is my little urban fantasy series. I've only got two out so far. And then I stopped because I had to switch and write the new epic fantasy. But so this little urban fantasy series, I wrote this book and it was like 45,000 words. And I showed it to my agent and she said, this is really fun. I really enjoy it. And she took it out to publishers. And publishers basically all came back and said, look, 45,000 words, that's like barely a book for science fiction and fantasy. Mm. We're not really interested in something that short.
Yeah, it's really that gray area between novella and novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so everybody kind of shot me down. I had a couple of people come back and say, oh, make it 40,000 words longer and we'll definitely take a stronger look.
Just double the word count.
Right. And I was like, I don't want to.
Yeah.
Like, this was just a fun side project for me. This is, you know, I write epic fantasy for a living at the moment. So I ended up just self-publishing it. And my agent was really cool with it. And she kind of, you know, gave me pointers and said, yeah, here, let's, if nobody else wants it, then do it yourself and make some money. And I did. And it worked out great. But yeah, it's that kind of, but there's great things about self-publishing. There's great things about traditional publishing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I've kind of straddled. I want to do kind of both of them in some way. I definitely wanted that experience with self-publishing. And theoretically in the future, I might self-publish some other novels. But I've also been like writing short stories and submitting those to magazines. I just want to get kind of the breadth of publishing experience that I can. To see where I really want to end up. So going back to what you were saying about like trying to recover the joy of reading and stuff like that, one thing that I have found that personally helps is that I read things that are entirely different to what I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that I have been trying over the last few years to read as much. So I didn't really write short stories. I wrote only kind of like novel type stuff. And then, so I decided, okay, I'm going to read short stories. And then I decided I'm going to read, you know, horror and biography type stuff and a lot more literary. So at the moment I'm reading Dostoevsky, which is like very much not what I write. And I guess for me personally, in terms of enjoyment, it's kind of like, I don't necessarily need to analyze it nearly as much or compare it to what I'm doing at the moment because it's a different playground.
Yeah.
Because I can see how it happens with epic fantasy. You know, you're writing epic fantasy, reading epic fantasy. I don't know how much you've read of like Sanderson or anything like that, but...
Quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, you were in his class, weren't you?
I was. I live right up the street from him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Are you guys like tight?
I mean, I'm not going to claim that we're tight, but no. Brandon is, I consider Brandon a friend and yeah. He's been very cool to me for my entire career.
He's been very cool to everyone. My goodness. He's such a good guy.
He really is. Brandon's lovely. I mentioned this on an episode I recorded recently, but one of the amazing things about living near him was that in the middle of the pandemic, when my wife and I were very uncomfortable going anywhere, I got to go watch Dune in his personal theater. And that was like one of those moments that I was like, this is the coolest thing I have ever experienced.
You got to watch Dune in his personal theater? Oh, yeah. How do you even get the rights to put a personal Dune showing in your own theater?
I mean, it was just on HBO Max, so he just played it on the theater.
We don't have all of your fancy schmancy like streaming services here in New Zealand. We're still stuck in 2005. So,
that is deeply unfortunate.
Oh no, that's really cool. But like, I mean, what else? What other things might you be interested in reading? Kind of like outside epic fantasy or sci-fi?
Honestly, for me, I do a lot of listening. I play a lot of video games, and so oftentimes, if I'm playing a solo video game that doesn't require a lot of brain space, I'll put on podcasts. And for me, it's for historical stuff. I love historical books, podcasts, anything that is like real life, but interesting, and with lots of fiddly political intrigue and wars and big battles and all the sorts of stuff. I eat that stuff up. And honestly, it's great because it's not exactly what I do for a living, but it feeds me both kind of my personal interests and my creativity, because it'll be like, oh.
Because you have your own politicking and politics and wars inside your own worlds.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of stuff, like right now I've been, I left off, there's a podcast called The Revolutions Podcast, which is absolutely amazing. And every season is a different revolution that they just cover in depth. And I think it was around the time the pandemic started, I just stopped listening because I wasn't driving anywhere anymore. And so I was about 20 episodes into the Russian Revolution, and I've been re-listening to those 20 episodes, and now I'm finally moving forward to get the rest of it. And I eat that stuff up. It's just so interesting, so cool to read about these, like, these historical figures and kind of these, it's almost like character analysis of real people, and learn what drives them, learn what mistakes they made, and, you know, how things went badly, how things went right, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. No, I wish that I could read and engage with more history stuff than I currently do. I got sent, now I'm not like, I don't know if you know who Dan Carlin is, but.
I love Dan Carlin.
Okay. Yeah. So I had not heard of him, but someone sent me his Japanese, the Bomb in the East series. And his World War One series.
Right. It was, is that one Ghosts of the Ostfront? Is that one?
I don't remember. It's like, he does one episode for each year or something of the war.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. I remember listening to that, and I really enjoyed those. Just for the commentary, it's nice to get like a deep, slow look at a lot of this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know? I find that stuff fascinating.
No, that is great. I love exactly that kind of thing. Like I said, it's that mixture of being able to feed my creativity, but also I'm really interested in what's going on.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's good for bike rides. It's good for when I'm playing video games, you know, et cetera. But that's kind of almost kind of filled the niche that I used to, that used to be for me, you know, reading voraciously.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so with you kind of coming into this writing career, I'm curious, what is the coolest thing that you have stumbled across online to do with your work?
Oh, man. I mean, I think probably, like, do you mean like reviews and things like that, or just?
I mean, like you found a particular review with a quote. You found fan art. You found discussions of a particular idea that's like, you're like, oh my gosh, you're dead right on a thing that I wasn't meaning to reveal yet. You know?
Yeah. No, I've done all of the above. I've come across great reviews that always make me feel all nice. I've come across bad reviews that make me feel shitty for the rest of the day.
Oh man, bad reviews though. How do you take it? How do you?
Man, with bad reviews, it's like I guess early in my career, I looked at every single review, and the rule of thumb is to never look at reviews.
Yeah.
But like I was discussing recently with Brian Stavely on this podcast about this idea of like, where's the happy medium? And you know, we were talking about this idea of reading a lot of reviews all at once, so that you're not focusing on any single one. You're getting a general flavor of what people like and don't like. And I like that.
That's a lovely idea, but I am a hyper, I will read 100 reviews and like read the one that says, man, he's kind of bad. And I'll be like, oh, I'm a bad. Yeah.
No, I mean, there's no real like, gosh, like I feel like you're probably bombarded with audience feedback way more than I am, even like, because you have to engage on this on like a monthly or weekly basis. Like for me, I'm like, oh, I've got a new book out once every year or two kind of thing.
YouTube is very much like that. There's a constant stream of comments. When I first started, I read every single comment, and I continued that for a long time. You'd waste hours reading every single comment. And then Twitter, you know, you're getting comments back on that. And people are very hypercritical. They assume so much about you from the smallest things, right down to like who you follow on a particular thing on Instagram, on Twitter. You know, they'll be like, well, you must agree with all this, that, or, you know, you must believe these things. Or if you say this thing, then it must mean that you believe all these other things, which are vaguely connected in this circle to whatever. And of course, people love to extrapolate about that stuff. It's a weird world to navigate. I have since basically stopped looking at comments and reviews just because it's so stressful.
That's probably healthy. I think that reviews can give you something that you can use for improving yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there is a very high risk of it just totally torpedoing your self-esteem, you know, like destroying your ability to get any work done. Like, it's just, it's hard to engage with that kind of thing because you want to engage with your audience.
Mm.
I think a lot of people, that's their instinct, is I want to talk to them. I want to find out what they like and don't like and all that stuff. And then you do it and you feel awful.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's different than that. I think a lot of it is that sometimes you'll get feedback and you'll be like, the feedback's correct, absolutely, but you kind of already knew that that was kind of a thing you need to work on, and then getting hammered over and over with that, just told constantly, it's like, yes, I know, I'm working on it, that sort of thing. It can be quite demoralizing, you know, like if I've written a story or something like that, and I'll be like, I'm pretty proud of the story. And the comments will be, you know, oh, this particular thing just didn't work. It was really badly paced. And I'm like, I know the story's not that well paced, but I like a lot of the other parts of it. I'm still working on my ability to pace things. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What have you ever found useful feedback from random reviews?
That's a tough question to answer. Like I was mentioning, like I think getting a vague idea. Mm-hmm. Of what people are kind of maybe dissatisfied with, or like the biggest criticism that maybe you can scrape off of lots of different people's opinions.
Mm.
You know, that kind of thing is helpful for me in terms of shaping the direction I want to go as an author over the next 5 years, kind of thing.
Mm.
But beyond that, it's not useful. You know, if somebody gives me a review and said, "Oh, these characters were terrible," oftentimes the very next review will be, I loved all the characters, you know, so it's the exact opposite.
Yeah. There's so many contradictory opinions. It's hard to figure out what is like actual helpful critique and what is just people being passionately annoying.
Yeah. So, I mean, yes and no, it's kind of hard to answer that. It's a weird place to be in. And I think maybe probably the healthiest thing is to not engage at all.
Mm.
But every author, every creative kind of has to decide what level of, you know, fan engagement, you know, learning from your audience you want to kind of deal with.
Whose opinion do you trust then?
Ooh, man.
I mean, I don't know what your beta reading system is like. I don't know if it's like, I mean, I don't know if your wife reads your books and gives you feedback.
My wife always reads my books.
Yeah.
I recently started last summer, I started a dedicated beta reading group for my new series.
Mm-hmm.
And they really helped. And I think that I think my own opinion is what I trust the most at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been doing this enough that I have a pretty good gut instinct for whether something is working or not.
Mm-hmm.
But beta readers are very useful for if I have a gut instinct of whether something's working, beta readers can, if a bunch of them agree with me,
yeah,
then it confirms it.
You're looking for trends.
Yeah. Often they'll say, okay, I agree with, I think that this is wrong and this is the reason why. And it helps me diagnose what's going on, what I'm trying to, you know, kind of sort out in my own head. And that's really quite invaluable.
I also find it's very often kind of a little bit opposite like that, in the sense that a lot of beta readers will tell me, hey, I don't like this chapter, I don't like this part, but they'll all have different ideas about why. And I usually seem to find that they're really good at figuring out when something is wrong, but not necessarily why it's wrong.
Yeah.
And that's, again, that's something you trust. So you trust kind of these beta readers, your wife, as like ways to find feedback.
Yeah. And I mean, at the end of the day, my agent and my editor, of course, they're genuinely professionals.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, this is what they do for a living. And so, you know, that, but I always try to, because I know I'm one of only, you know, 30, 40 authors for them. And so I try to always like give them the best that I can rather than constantly bombarding them with, you know, like, oh, here's a new thing I'm worried about. How do I fix it? Kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So they're my last line of defense.
No, absolutely. Have you ever, what's a moment that you've not clashed, but like disagreed with creatively with your editor or agent?
Oh man, I almost always agree with them, to be honest.
Maybe they're just that brilliant.
I like to think that we're all geniuses.
We're all geniuses. Yeah.
And so we always agree, right? No, I always agree with them. I think that sometimes it'll take me a couple of weeks to come around on something.
Mm.
Like if my editor comes back and says, oh, this is, I don't like this particular X thing. Usually I'll understand why immediately. But on the occasion that I don't, I'll go away and think about it for a couple of weeks. And I'll usually come around to it. I don't think I've pushed back more than a handful of times. And whenever I push back, my editor's really good about saying, okay, you're the writer. You do what you want.
Mm.
And I don't think it's none of it's been memorable enough for me to give an anecdote about. So
No. That's fair.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Are you the only brain working behind your YouTube channel and your content?
Almost. So I write everything, I perform everything. Everything that is written on screen, that is on screen, is designed vaguely by me. I have an editor who edits my videos, and that's primarily because I needed time. I basically got to the point where I was like, I want to dedicate more time to my writing, and so I'm deciding to hire an editor, and I did. And I sent him a script annotated with notes, have this stuff on screen, have this stuff on screen, have this scene at this point. And so I have a decent amount of input into the creative look of a video. But anytime that I do a bigger project, he tends to have a bit more of a creative role in producing the video. But everything that is fundamentally written and created and all the ideas for scripts and stuff are me, yes.
Do you like having that kind of level of responsibility? Or is there part of you that wishes there was somebody else in the mix?
I'm a control freak on that front. I have a friend who is bringing on a second writer to the channel, and I cannot fathom doing that. I can get rid of the editing because editing's not a passion of mine. It's not something I'm amazing at. It's sort of something I did through the nature of the job, but it's also not a way that it's not a thing I want to be known for, you know, whereas the writing is like, that's the content. That's the stuff I'm creating and putting out. So ultimately I don't have any people helping me research or anything like that. I do know people who have hired researchers. And they're helpful, but they're also more often for, you know, like science channels and maths channels and history channels, where if you go and tell someone, you say, go and find me the causes of the Russian Revolution, there's a lot more concrete answers you can find for that. A lot more like literal quotes, you know. But if I go tell a person, go and find me the best ways to create a character, that's just so much more vague, and I don't feel like I can trust anyone but myself to navigate that in a way that I feel confident to present that information.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's how I feel about my writing. You kind of about my prose, you know, like this is me. This is the core of who I am as a career person, as an artist, a career artist.
Mm.
Like the writing has to be mine. And I don't know, like I'm constantly thinking like, okay, I've reached the point in my career where I need to have like other people doing things for me. Like I need to have delegation here and there. But I constantly end up finding myself like the idea of having an assistant who checked my emails for me. Honestly, that would probably cut a few hours out of my week. But holy crap, like somebody else rooting through my email, it sounds so incredibly weird to me.
Yeah, I have missed a good. I'm not very good with time management. the rule of my life is that if I'm interested and passionate about doing something, then I'm really good at it. And if I'm not, then I'm just bunk. And so my fiance does tell me, oh my gosh, fiance, she's not my girlfriend, not my wife, we are literally engaged, so I have to use the term, but she said, you know, you need an assistant to like to make sure you actually get to meetings on time and you respond to all your emails. But it's it feels so, I don't know, weird to think about that,
isn't it? It's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm gonna, even if my career like hits that next pitch, you know, if it jumps up another notch, I feel like I'm still gonna push back on it. Like it's gonna just be such a weird thing.
Mm. What is the next step? The next pitch? The next step up?
I mean, I guess I'm in a kind of a bizarre spot where I have made a very good living as an epic fantasy writer for a decade,
mm-hmm.
but I've never hit a bestseller list. I mean, if you don't count like the Amazon, whatever, you know, all the kind of little fiddly things, I've never hit a bestseller list. And so I don't know. Bestseller lists are one of those weird things where everybody knows they're kind of bullshit, but they're also,
but everyone wants them anyway.
Everybody wants them anyway. Right. Cause they still do. They mean vaguely that you're doing quite well. Right.
Yeah.
And so. So I guess my next level is I'd love to hit a bestseller list with maybe my next series that's out in a couple months. We'll see.
Yeah.
But I don't really have anything to complain about because, you know, Powder Mage, I still most of my bills are paid by the royalties on books I haven't written for several years now, which is awesome.
Mm.
And yeah, I'm in a very fortunate position with that. I guess that's my next step. I mean, how about for somebody like you? What is the next step for, because, you know, we've talked about your passion with writing,
mm-hmm.
but that's slightly different than what you do with YouTube. And so I guess that's two different questions. One question is your next step as a writer, and the other question is your next step as a YouTuber.
It's complicated and deeply intertwined. So I was having a talk with a friend the other day on the weekend about basically those two questions, where I'm going. And when I first started out, you know, I've got 500 subscribers. I've got to turn this into something now. Great. Turns it into 2,000. Awesome. 2,000's great. Let's turn it into 10,000. Let's turn it into 100,000. And 100,000, you're at the point now, usually, where you've got a sustained audience. You can get 10,000 subscribers and not, and like have no follow through into the future. 100,000, you're usually building something a bit more. To be clear, by the way, subscribers are the worst way to actually measure a channel for a bunch of algorithmic reasons. It's complicated. But so I was kind of always thinking about how do I develop the channel a lot more and make it sustainable? All right. So I'm making it sustainable by always catering to the audience that I've got, trying to evolve it, make it longer lasting, make it broader. But fundamentally looking at what they want and providing that. And I really fell into my stride when I had writing and world building content that really opened up what my audience was and found like, oh, this is now I'm doing something that matters to me personally. And eventually you get to the point where you're kind of like, all right, how flexible can I be? How much do I have to upload? How much do I have to cater to what they want, or will they stick around for me? How sustainable is that? And I've been at that sort of experimental point where I can take a step back, not worry that much about constant uploads. You know, I started off doing 3 videos a week, fell down to 2, fell down to 1, now 1 every 2 weeks, now 1 every 2 to 3 weeks. You know, it drops away in that sense. And so the next level is really, can I use this to do anything I want with the channel in many senses? And I, to be clear, I love doing writing and world building content, so that's definitely going to continue. But like Avatar The Last Airbender content has been a huge part of my channel, but I have considered kind of moving that to a second channel, toning that down in some way for a bunch of complicated reasons. But yeah, so the next level YouTuber would be try and make it so that I can release short stories on the YouTube channel, theoretically. That'd be really cool. And as a writer, I started writing short stories as about September last year, and I wanted to get those published because I was kind of like, mm-hmm. I want to have some publications under my belt in some way. And I have. I've got 2 now, and I hopefully have a 3rd soon.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah, I'm stoked with how it's going. I've had so many closes, but like I cannot tell you how many times I have had emails being like, putting you through to the final round, and then it's no. Then it's still rejected. But yeah, that's a way to develop that writing side. And I want to kind of use the meld it closer with my YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And finish the sci-fi novel, get that on submission, and get that published. And theoretically, I've been talking with a bunch of other people. Maybe we might be doing an anthology of short stories released Kickstarter style. We'll see.
That's very cool. Well, and it's, you know, you mentioned this a bit earlier, kind of that the way that anything that you do, and you were saying this in terms of, you know, like self-publishing and stuff like that, but anything you do is going to, by nature of what you do for a living, connect back to your part as a public figure with a lot of followers, right?
Yes.
And so that's I find that kind of thing really fascinating. I talked with Daniel Green on this mm-hmm. podcast about the same thing of, you know, whether you want to or not, if you end up doing anything else creatively outside of your YouTube channel, it's going to come back to the YouTube channel and it's going to be involved.
I am always cultivating public image, whether I want to or not.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it's a weird world to exist in, where everything you do, I guess, is part of generating that. Because I mean, in some sense, you get to sort of take a step back for a year or two and then appear back on the scene. You know,
right? Which is, you know, it's a weird place because I have this theory about the way that authors kind of remain or don't remain in the public consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually quite dislike having to not be in the public consciousness for most of my work time, you know, most of my work year, because I feel like when there's so many good books coming out, so many new authors coming up and everything like that, you're kind of competing with everybody, not in an aggressive sort of horrible way, but just you're competing with everyone else for everybody's brain space.
Yeah.
And the more people remember your name, and we mentioned Brandon earlier,
mm-hmm.
Brandon is so saturated in terms of, you know, he's now got his YouTube channel and he's always coming up on best lists and everything like that. This kind of saturation is really good for authors. And I find it kind of funny because I think a lot of authors look at some of you YouTubers who start off as YouTubers and then shift over to writing. Some of us would absolutely kill for that kind of built-in audience.
I've been told that. I've been told that before. I've been told, you know, like, you have no idea
yeah.
how incredible it is that you have this platform that you do. And I'm like, I know. I'm trying to exploit it. I am doing my best. Like,
yeah, yeah. Keep on piling the pressure on.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm writing short stories. I'm getting them published. I'm getting this sci-fi novel because I wrote a book and I've had it out on submission with agents for a while. no real luck. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. That is fine. I've got another, I almost started writing short stories because I was like, am I just shit at writing? Am I just bad? And I was like, no. The first short story I wrote got nearly picked up by Clark's World. I cannot be that bad. Yeah, I was really stoked at that. First story sent it to Clark's World was like one of the biggest magazines in sci-fi out there at the moment. And I got through to the final round and then rejected, but still ego boost. Anyways, I wrote them and I was feeling
always an ego boost.
Always need an ego boost. And I was like, am I just bad? No, I can't be bad. So I've written 60,000 words, 70,000 words into a sci-fi novel, which I'm going to finish. And then I'm going to get that on submission. And my aim is to have that out with agents by the end of the year as like, I have to exploit this audience now or I'm going to lose it all, which is just, I know it's the terror of it all going to fall apart. And I know it's not going to fall apart, but it feels like it will.
Right, but yeah, and it's hard because when you do these things professionally, because you don't have a novel out, but you have been writing for your YouTube channel for years, and yes, you have experience, you know how businesses work, you know how these things, the ebb and flow of these things, right?
Yeah,
and it is true that you kind of have to take advantage of any time you are in the public spotlight to continue to keep yourself in the public spotlight.
Why don't you just cause some drama, you know? Cause some drama and then just be like, and by the way, Patamage.
right. Do something, say something absolutely horrible, but then like...
And then use it to promote.
Right. I mean, that sounds so stressful because there are people who do that. And it just sounds like... I wouldn't be able to sleep at night.
Who does that? No, you don't need to name anyone. I'm sure they're out there.
I'm thinking more of like political pundits who have new crappy tell-all books out and stuff like that.
Oh, they do. They totally do. You know, the truth behind the... Oh, goodness. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a weird world almost constantly being in the public eye in some senses. Like I know Daniel, you know, when he was putting out his books, like it's complicated because it's hard to experiment with yourself in the public eye, or experiment with your writing, because everything is met with such high critique. And I know that he struggled with that a little bit, and that's totally understandable. But you can't really retreat from the public eye in a lot of that a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, and it's especially for guys like you, because you guys with the YouTube and everything, it's, you're in the public eye all the time. Like we mentioned, you're putting out content on a very regular basis. You know, if a writer if a novelist who otherwise isn't really around, if they put out a different book than what they normally get, yeah, they'll get some emails, they'll get some complaints, but otherwise, you know, people kind of pass it by, you know, unless they're one of the massive writers, right? But otherwise people just kind of pass it by and it's fine. It's not a big deal. But for guys like you that are putting out constant content, there are all these built-in expectations. There's all this public, like reader audience feedback, right? That's not just constant, but immediate, you know, like you can post a video. And I imagine that within the amount of time it takes for that video to post and then be watched a single time, you've got comments already.
Oh yeah. Yeah. 100%. There are people who comment before watching as a way of like asserting themselves on the comment section. It is like that. And it's all compounded by constantly measuring yourself numerically, you know, by views and whatsoever. And part of my growth over the last while has been trying to shift away from kind of constantly measuring myself and views. And it's YouTube measures your videos against one another, your last 10 videos.
Yeah.
So you'll be told when you put out a video, whether it's number one, number two, number three, number four, number five, number six, number seven, number eight, number nine, 10. And that's at the relative time of it being posted. So they're like, at this point, your other videos were doing this well. And sometimes it's nice because you get a 1 out of 10 or a 2 out of 10 or a 3 out of 10. But like in my brain, if I'm getting a 4 out of 10, it feels like I failed, you know. But of course, something has to be the 4 out of 10, you know, like they can't all be 1, 2s, and 3s. And so that's it. When you're constantly kind of measuring yourself against the algorithm,
yeah,
it can stifle your creativity sometimes because you're trying to constantly grab as much of the audience as possible. And you're looking at, oh, what do I have to create right now to get that 1 out of 10? And that's not necessarily coinciding with your passions. So I was going to ask, like, does that ever enter your writing at all? Like, you write to appease the trends, appease the people in a way that you know that some projects won't hit others as won't hit the algorithm as well?
Oh, I mean, it's different in terms of what I'm trying to appease, but yes, very much so. You know, because saying I don't want to be a slave to the algorithm, or I don't want to be a slave to, for me, it would be to my epic fantasy fans.
Yeah.
You know, like saying that is way easier than actually doing it, because delivering to those fans, to those watchers, to the audience that is used to a certain type of content, you know, that's what pays your mortgage or your rent or your car payment, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
So it's really easy to say, oh, I'm going to write something super weird. You know, I'm going to take a left-hand turn into something different. And that's, you can say that, but you also might have a book totally bomb, or in your case, a video totally bomb.
Yeah.
You know?
But honestly, it's also the writing, because I'm, so people, believe it or not, because of the content I make, think I'm writing a giant epic world-built fantasy. All right?
Yeah.
Now, the weird thing is, I love studying those types of books. I'm not actually really that big on writing them. I like writing small casts, narrow, like, visions, personal stakes, where the magic or the science is usually the background, mm-hmm. you know? Annihilation hit me so well because it's such a deeply personal book. You know, I am someone who loves John Green's novels, right? I like YA fiction because it's often so psychological in terms of like how deeply you get into I read a lot about mental illness and self-harm and suicide and stuff like that, because I have a lot to do with that in I volunteer at a helpline. I was gonna say I have a lot to do with that personally, but that would have come off wrong. Yeah, so I like writing those sorts of books, but everyone's going to be expecting me to come out with, you know, a Powder Mage style story.
Yeah, big, deep world building, the kind of stuff that you have taught on your channel and in your books.
Yes, absolutely. And so they're going to read and they're going to be like, the hell is this? What are you giving us here? What's these characters? You know? so I'm a little bit worried about that. And then the science fiction novel that I've got, even though like it does have a multi-consciousness, multi-dimensional alien coursing across the stars to come for Earth, it's got a probe landing on the planet, it's still fundamentally about a young mother who just lost her child and isn't able to recover from that. Like, that's the story.
Yeah.
It's so I like those sorts of stories, and I am worried about how that's going to be received when I, you know, release the book.
Well, and it's funny because you will immediately get comments from people saying, why didn't you think of the fans? And the fact is that you will have thought about it constantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know ahead of time what everybody's complaints are going to be. And sometimes you want to do something different regardless of what you can foresee with your existing audience.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. I don't know. We'll see how it turns out.
It's all right. You have to just remember that every single author out there has those same paranoias and same worries. And, you know, sometimes they end up justified and sometimes they don't. And you'll always have gotten something out there and you'll have tried it. And that's, I guess, at the end of the day, you know, especially when you have a very successful other career to fall back on, you know, it's not too bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I always remind myself, despite the unique challenges that I face in my job, I do live in the most fortunate life that I could live in, basically. You know, not only do I live in New Zealand, which It's, I know no one else thinks about New Zealand, but I am so fortunate to have grown up here. But
I think New Zealand, everything I've seen of New Zealand is so stinking gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, amazing country, and I love it very much. But obviously also I fell into this job, and I'm incredibly fortunate to have done so. People say, you know, you work really hard, Tim, you know, you work this many hours, this many days a week. You know, there was a time when there was years where I worked like, you know, 9 a.m. till 9 at night at university while also studying. And I have since drawn that back a lot. I have really good, reasonable hours now. But people go, you know, you worked so hard, but people don't realize how much luck I've had as well, how much out of control this was for me. Yeah, I tried, but I also lucked into it. And I try not to forget that.
There is always an element of luck with creative businesses, you know, because you have to, the stars have to align, right? You have to have the right reviews. You have to have for the right algorithms. You have to have the right things happen at the right time to get people to even notice you exist, let alone to then become a success.
Yeah. I mean, so much of it, even in book publishing, is the right story at the right time.
Oh yeah.
You know, you could, there are books coming out now, which if published in 2005 would have not have heard a blink, you know, and there are books that came out in 2005 that if they came out now might be massive sellers, but aren't. It's just the nature of the industry, you know, like Hard Magic Systems, you know, in, I guess sort of in the wake of that Sanderson explosion, became really big, fast sellers in the same way that, you know, in the wake of Tolkien, you had all of those high fantasy stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Powder Mage came out just a couple of months before Django Wexler's Thousand Names. And so I barely beat Django for being the guy at the very front of the Flintlock fantasy trend.
Yeah.
And so like that was just pure luck. And Django's books are amazing. And he gets brought up all the time with the same subgenre, but I still feel like I've like just barely squeaked in there to have that, to whenever Flintlock fantasy is mentioned, I'm probably mentioned as well. And it's like, oh, that's quite cool, but it's totally luck.
Yeah. I mean, you could have lost that 2 months on a publishing, like, you know, deadline basically, rather than anything else necessarily.
Exactly.
I don't know what the gap is between you finishing a book and it actually getting published, but it's quite a long while.
Yeah, it's like a year. Like it's a long time.
A year? Is it a year?
It's I think two publishers, the ideal is a year, but it can be as short as like 6 months, but it's, I think they prefer to have a longer lead time.
Mm.
You know, of course, if George R. R. Martin turns in a new book tomorrow, it'll be out in 3 months, right? But
sorry, George R. R. Martin turning in a book. I'm sorry, not familiar with that phrase.
Doesn't happen very often.
I watched the first two seasons of Game of Thrones, and my friend's like, Tim, you need to read the books. And I'm like, the series is already really good. And he's like, yeah, but the books are so much better. And I read all of them, like, really quickly. And I'm still waiting. Oh, gosh. I was going to say something. So on the topic of, like, YouTuber books and stuff like that, are you familiar with Lindsay Ellis at all?
My wife has watched a lot of her stuff. I have not. I'm familiar with the person, right? Like, I know of her, but I don't know the stuff.
Okay, all right. So it's not that interesting a story, in which case, if you don't know, but she brought out a science fiction book, which did actually strike the New York Times bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read the book. It's good. But I think in the same way that, you know, the irony is that people look at kind of YouTubers and be like, well, you only hit the bestseller list because you have a big audience who's going to propel that to it. And there's an element of truth to that, you know, like we can mobilize audiences a lot easier than other people. But Lindsay Ellis did bring out a sci-fi book and people have definitely looked down on her for sort of hijacking the publishing industry. Not that that's legitimate.
Yeah, and it's complicated. Even like I imagine from your end, like we've been talking about, is that it's that complicated because you don't want to be seen to be that person, right?
No.
But you also absolutely know that for the good of your career, you should be that person.
That's honestly, that has been why I wanted to like publish short stories. I was kind of like, I don't want to be seen as someone who just gets published because of my audience.
Yeah.
And for the record, I've had a book out with agents for the last while and I've gotten nothing, despite the fact that I put in there, you know, I have a nearly million fold audience here. So, I mean, it does not always pay off. Absolutely.
And it's hard to try to kind of to sort through those waters, right?
Mm.
To sort out, you know, what's good for you personally versus professionally.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, a lot of audience, people that don't do this for a living, they don't really understand all of the complicated feelings that go into that kind of thing.
Yeah, people just don't know how these jobs work. You know, every single time someone asks me, oh, you're a YouTuber, although technically they ask, what do you do for a job? And I say, I create educational online content. Because if I say I'm a YouTuber, there's two options. Number one, they think I'm Jake Paul. Or number two, they think I, you know, live in a basement and have no money and have no prospects.
That is exactly the response that you get when you say epic fantasy and author.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is. It's either they think that you're George R. R. Martin or that you live in your mom's basement. And it's like, no, I have a nice house and I make a decent living and I have.
I know, but you don't want to be that person who goes like, trust me, I make money, you know.
Right, exactly.
I have a house. As I smoke my Cuban cigar, I like.
Right. Yeah. Right, and it's like, I think people don't really get this idea that there's this happy middle ground between being, yeah, you know, a multimillionaire creator versus being,
no,
you
they
know,
don't.
A troglodyte.
But that's so weird to me because in my brain, author is such a respected profession. Like if someone said I'm an author, I'm like, awesome, you know, like, and I know tons of people who are still authors but don't make that much money, you know, and this, it's still, to me, I look at them and I go, you're pursuing your passion, that's cool, you know.
Among authors, authors are not respectable people.
Oh, what,
we all look at each other like, you again, huh?
my competition, my rival. It's a weird world to be in, but yes, people assume that I either, you know, go to the suicide forest in Japan or I don't have any prospects whatsoever.
Right.
So I have to sort of start off with that. And then my friends will usually be like, no, he does this. We'll see how it happens when I guess I'm an author, you know?
Like, and then you can feel what it's like to not actually be respectable like you'd hope.
Yeah, I work all my life just to be called an author and it's just the same.
I have bad news for you.
I mean, epic fantasy, I would not look down on an epic fantasy author at all. I think it's cool. I think it's great.
Hey, you know what? I'll take it.
Yeah.
Can I put that on my tombstone?
Absolutely. I think it's cool. Tim Hickson, 2022. There you go.
Yes. All right. You know what? I'll take that. I'm going to take that. That's fantastic. Well, hey, man, I have been keeping you for quite a long time, but I like to wrap these conversations up by asking, what's the last thing that you ate that you loved, that blew your mind?
The last thing that I ate that blew my mind. That I loved or that blew my mind? Because those are two different things.
You know what? Either one.
Okay. I made a homemade pizza on the weekend and I have very cheap tastes, but I made the dough and then we just put tomatoes and cheese and I bought this chorizo from the supermarket and that to me was just stellar. And then the most recent thing that blew my mind is a sugary treat that my friend made called crack, which...
Sugary treat, huh?
No, no. So what it is, it's basically a layer of caramelized sugar at the bottom. And then I don't know what you call them. We would call them like water crackers. They're like really bland. They're the blandest cracker you can imagine. Sometimes they're a bit salted and they've got little holes.
Yeah, so like a saltine.
Salt, is that a...
I think over here it would be a saltine.
Yes, a saltine. Yeah. So okay. It's literally just caramelized sugar, like with caramel flavor, saltine crackers, and then chocolate on the top. And it is the worst thing for you, but it had the most amazing taste. I did not expect it to be as good as it was. There we go.
That sounds like a homemade candy bar. Like,
it basically was, yeah. And just breaks it up into shards.
I'm game for that. That sounds great.
Yeah. What about yourself? Do you give your answer, or is it just me?
Yeah, but if I gave my answer, then it would be the same thing every single episode.
That's true. Yeah.
I will tell you that I've got two nieces that are in college nearby where I live. Mm-hmm. And so I started last summer, as soon as COVID restrictions started lightening up, started doing family dinner every month. And I do a lot of smoked meats and things like that. And so I made ribs. I made smoked ribs last night for my nieces.
Oh, smoked ribs. That's
and good. They came out so good.
Yeah. No, I'm jealous. Ribs are like peak.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I love smoked meats too much. I'm like, I keep telling myself, okay, back off on all the meat. Try to eat a little healthier. I'm trying to replace more of the dark meat with chicken. You know, stuff like that, but I love eating too much.
That's, I mean, hey, it's all a weakness we all have. I recently gained a bit of weight, and I'm like, oh no, I need to eat a bit better.
It's how it always goes.
Yeah.
That was YouTuber Tim Hickson. Thanks again to Tim for taking the time to chat. You can find links to Tim's YouTube channel and world-building books down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. Don't forget that my next epic fantasy, In the Shadow of Lightning, is now up for pre-order. You can also get signed copies of my books directly from my website or swag from my Redbubble store. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review. Huge thanks to Kyle Anderson, Patrick Hunt, Elijah, Jennifer and Angela Johnson, and Ivor Gullickson for their backing on Patreon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.